You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of May, 2016, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, as the Iraqi army goes head-to-head with Islamic State in Fallujah, we'll ask what's at stake in the fight. Turkey's president has designated the movement of his old ally and current enemy as a terrorist group. We'll look at what Erdogan has against Fethullah Gulen. All that plus Israel's new far-right defense minister and the French fight for labor reforms. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London, and Nina Schick from the EU policy think tank Open Europe. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start today with the situation in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. It was the first city to fall to Islamic State back in 2014, and it's the second largest city currently under the control of IS in Iraq. That's after Mosul. Well, the ongoing operation to retake the city by Iraqi forces has seen today IS forces fighting back. Rosemary, let's start with you. Explain to us the significance of retaking Fallujah for the Iraqi government and the fight against IS.
Well, part of the fight being put up by the Iraqi government is being undertaken by Shia militia, and that is one of the problems that's going to surface in the event, which is probably the case, that they succeed in retaking Fallujah from ISIS, because ISIS can put up a much stronger fight and have much more support by the locals against Shia militia. They're seen to be in the hands of Iran. They're seen to be heretics in the eyes of the ISIS creed of Islam. And this is all very well in terms of a fight between two major players inside Iraq, which I think you can anticipate that the Baghdad government, with some help from the Americans and the Iran-backed Shia militia, will succeed in winning. But then what is the big question we should all be asking.
And your then what, Rosemary, is will it be possible to hold the city, or will there be an uprising in more violence, sectarian violence?
Well, I mean, one of the backstories is that the situation of the population in Fallujah is pretty dire in humanitarian terms. They've been under blockade for months, which is part of the softening up process by the Baghdad government against ISIS. But that therefore turns into a Pyrrhic victory, because if a lot of the population of Fallujah, which has been battered a number of times since the invasion of 2003, is exhausted. Many of them are dead. A lot of them are starving. Humanitarian aid has not been able to get through. And insofar as the city is being bombarded, it will need rebuilding. And the principally Shia-dominated Iraqi government forces and the militia that are helping them are not in a position to take forward governance for the Baghdad government in a place like Fallujah, which is in Anbar province. It's part of the Sunni Arab heartland, and will not take kindly to rule from Baghdad if that's equated with Iran.
Nina, two interesting facts raised there. One, I guess, is what the humanitarian backstory is, because we tend to ignore that a little bit when these fights are going on. The dominance is in all the show and force that we're seeing on the ground. But for these communities who are trapped, we understand that barely one family has managed to get out of the city in recent days. Potentially a catastrophic humanitarian story. And then the second story is what that then does, as Rosemary's saying, for how you hold a city together, how you make it feel that this was a good thing to happen for them.
Yeah, undoubtedly there's a humanitarian disaster potentially unfolding when you hear about 50,000 citizens trapped in the city with no way out. But I think, as Rosemary correctly correctly pointed out, there is also the question of which forces the citizens of Fallujah will be loyal to. I mean, the fact that it was the first to fall to IS is not only a coincidence, as Rosemary pointed out, you know, it was also a stronghold of resistance during the American invasion. And I don't think that many of the fighters, in fact, many of the fighters in Fallujah who are really, you know, entrenched now, ready to go, the IS fighters, a lot of them aren't foreign fighters. They're actually from Fallujah, which then raises the question, okay, so if they really see this as a fight to the death, and if it is the Shia militia coming in afterwards, and they get to decide, you know, who's an IS militant and who's just a regular civilian, that raises a lot of grey area and a lot of potential for things to go wrong.
And the Americans are going to get more blame for stirring up sectarian tension by backing forces like the Shia militia, and indeed in the north of Iraq, backing Kurdish Peshmerga, not Arabs, against ISIS in the north of Iraq, as well as in the north of Syria. And this all leads locals, and as we hear across the Arab media, leads to the perception that the Americans are becoming part of the problem.
A simple question, is IS done for? Rosemary?
I don't think so. I'm afraid, since we know that IS morphed out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that ISIS, if defeated on the battlefield, will morph into something else. I mean, it's about more than just armed forces.
But the use of the word state will become a bit of a sham in coming months, do you think?
Well, I don't think the contiguity of Iraq or Syria are at all assured. So I don't think we're at the end game yet. And what I would see potentially emerging, if the Russians and the Russian-backed Assad regime survives with substantial territory in Syria, and the Iranian-backed, substantially Shia government in Baghdad survives with most of the southern part of the country in Iraq, I think you can expect parties like the Saudis, the Emirates, and the Turks to make sure that geographically speaking, the west of Iraq and the east of Syria come together in some kind of new dispensation, which does represent Sunni Arabs.
Another simple question for you, Nina. Why suddenly are there these victories? They may be Pyrrhic victories, but they are victories. And we watched in, you know, bemusement almost, as the Iraqi army in the past 2 or 3 years would often face a small number of IS fighters and would be dispersed or captured or killed. Suddenly they're beginning to have a turnaround. Is it because, as Rosemary was saying, it's because of the Iranians and their ability to organise the Iraqi army because of American firepower? Why do you think there has been this turnaround in the fortune of the Iraqis?
Well, I think that when IS, you know, suddenly rose to the international stage in 2014, you know, some commentators were surprised. But really, there was no reason to be surprised if you look at the evolution of IS and, you know, their roots in Al-Qaeda. Like Rosemary pointed out, they went away, regrouped and came back as another group. So I don't think that IS, even if they're struggling right now under strategic and military defeats, this is going to destroy the group at all, because this is a philosophy that I think we're just at the beginning of, you know, a 100-year conversation, maybe longer. Having said that, of course, when they came to the international stage, everyone was shocked and horrified. And of course, IS has really pushed for that shock factor in terms of their slick social media production, in terms of like the films that they've produced, the beheadings. So lots of different groups have become involved. So, you know, it's seen as, you know, we have to take down IS. This is the epitome of evil. You have the American airstrikes, you have the British airstrikes, you have, you know, the Russian involvement. Therefore, they have suffered setbacks. But I don't think
across the region they are seen as the epitome of evil.
No.
I agree with you. In Europe,
yeah,
and more or less in North America, but to a lesser extent than in Europe, they are the main problem. But in the region, almost every constituency can think of something worse.
So in Fallujah, do you feel that many people, while maybe not overly sympathetic to IS, felt that they weren't any worse than anything else that had happened in recent years?
Yeah, though you have to take into account that they've been under siege for 9 months, and so any rescue from that situation is what's going to be the first emotion. But you know, as was foreseen by the people who knew Iraq well, but not by the British government when the invasion of Iraq took place in 2003, there was an expectation that the Shia majority of Iraqis would welcome the invasion. They were glad to see the back of Saddam Hussein, but they didn't rush around celebrating the arrival of Westerners.
Rosemary, do you think that there is a possibility for Iraq at some point to come out of this and stay whole as a country, or it will be so federalized or pulled apart, you know, that we will have a Kurdish state, we will have a Sunni state, and we'll have a Shia state? Do you think there is a possibility, though, that with the right, unfortunately, with the right strongman and the right military might, that somebody could get back control of the whole country?
Well, the message is that only brutality works. And that was the message of Assad and of Saddam Hussein. And I think, unfortunately, insofar as all the other players have resorted to taking up arms or arming others to fight in both Iraq and Syria to pursue their agendas, nobody's modelling a peaceful, democratic way forward. And I just don't think that one can wish for it. And I think it was a mistake to think that the majorities, a majority of Shia Arabs in Iraq, would look after minority interests. And the same deal in Syria. I can't see that if the Sunni Arab majority in Syria gets their hands on power, that there will suddenly be magnanimity and reconciliation and so on. So I'm afraid it's a fragmentation that I see as opposed to order.
Well, we're going to move on to another country with its own problems at the moment. We're going to turn to Turkey, a country deep in crisis, not only from external forces such as a raging war on its doorstep in the form, again, of Islamic State, but also from domestic pressures. Turkey's president, Tayyip Erdogan, has today officially designated the religious movement of a former ally as a terrorist group. Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish preacher living in self-imposed exile in the US state of Pennsylvania, runs an international movement that Erdogan believes is trying to topple the government. So is Erdogan scapegoating the group as an excuse to clamp down on all opponents, or is something deeper going on? Nina, why is he so concerned about Fethullah Gulen?
Well, as you pointed out, they used to be allies, and I think they had a falling out a few years ago when he took a kinder position towards Kurdish resistance. And Erdogan, of course, is cracking down on all kinds of groups. This is one of the big reasons why talks with the EU and Erdogan are stalling, because Erdogan refuses to reform the anti-terrorism law, which includes journalists and civil society organizations all under the same brush of terrorism. And I think that the Hizmet movement, as it's known, had a lot of soft power. And for many years, it was used as a tool of Turkish soft power in Asia, in the Middle East, and also in Africa. So this is very much a battle for influence, because right now what Erdogan wants is for a lot of the Hizmet movement schools in sub-Saharan Africa, which has become a much more important trading partner for Turkey, given the economic turbulence in Europe and also the political and economic turbulence in the Middle East. He wants to replace his secular English schools with Turkish government-backed schools. So it's very much a fight for power and influence, soft influence included.
And I would say there was a personal dimension to this as well, because one of the reasons why they fell out was that Fethullah Gulen instigated, in effect, his supporters within the police forces and so on in Turkey to investigate Erdogan's inner circle. And Erdogan could do no wrong as of 2002, when the AK party just swept the board in successive elections. And he was seen like as a breath of fresh air. He was seen to stand for a fairly gentle or modest form of Islam, conservatism, but acknowledging the role of Islam in daily life, unlike the legacy of Ataturk, which was so aggressively secular. And for that period, Erdogan and Gulen could work together. But the fallings out come when they become rivals for power, and Erdogan feels that he's being threatened because not all his inner circle are behaving in an utterly straightforward and honourable fashion. There is corruption going on, which inevitably happens in any power elite if they're in power for too long and unchallenged.
Rosemary, how deep do you think is the real support, though, for Gulen? Because in a way now, anybody who stands up against Erdogan is, you know, castigated as being a supporter of Gulen. But we know that the judiciary and the police forces were kind of cleansed of people who are thought to be Gulen supporters. So is there really still a powerful constituency, or is it an imagined kind of enemy?
I think it's somewhere between the two. The crackdown on the Gulen movement has been over a period of time, since 2013. But it was a major task weeding them out to the extent that they have been of the fabric of the administration, including the police forces. And I wouldn't like to pronounce them gone completely. However, what everybody seems to agree on is that Erdogan's hold on the party machine, the AK party machine, is profound. And it would be suicidal to challenge him directly. And he seems to have got away with imprisoning all the journalists and defying all those who talk about Turkish tradition of free speech and democracy and so on. He's ousted the prime minister so that he can make the system more presidential with a more compliant prime minister. These kinds of moves, my sense is that there's massive opposition in Turkey, but not organized and not able to find, for the time being, a democratic route to stopping Erdogan's bid to make himself unassailable.
Nina, the other extraordinary thing is that maybe this would be seen by many governments as an internal issue, but the criticism from the West is so muted because of the migration issue and because, finally governments in Berlin and Vienna are a bit relieved that fewer migrants, well, almost no migrants now, are coming up via Turkey into Greece. So there's no kind of comment about it, and it's kind of leaving an odd vacuum where I presume that Erdogan feels that things are going his way in some sense.
Absolutely. I mean, and when you see the deal that Europe signed with Turkey, of course, all the kind of civil society, there was so much opposition to that deal here in Europe. But given what happened last summer and given how you see public opinion all across Europe, including especially in the kind of liberal north, sweeping to the far right and the political gains that far right anti-immigrant parties have made, quite astounding, as we just saw recently in the Austrian presidential election, where just by the tiniest of margins, you almost had an Austrian president who elected a far-right Austrian president for the first time since 1945 in Germany. A far-right anti-Islamic, anti-immigrant party, AfD, is polling on about 15%, which is exceptional for Germany. So given this, it is no wonder that the politicians felt, okay, well, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place and we have to make a compromise. Having said that, the deal is not done yet because the anti-terrorism law, reform to the anti-terrorism law, is the sticking point. And it's supposed to be concluded by this summer, but it certainly won't be. So I think the EU and European players are hoping that, with the carrot and stick approach, they can soften Erdogan by next year, but it certainly won't be happening this year. The deal, it won't be concluded.
And then Erdogan's holding out for this business of freedom to travel for Turks.
Which has become a hot potato in the Brexit vote here. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with Nina Schick and Rosemary Hollis right after this, when we're going to be talking about politics in Israel and France.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities, and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
From glitzy dance numbers and well-loved show tunes to conga lines, entertainment is key to cruising success. Monocle's Robert Bound grabs a lounger and joins in the fun.
As night falls, the entertainment starts in earnest. And it's time to start the music, it's time to light the lights and be serenaded by old smoothies, acrobats, the song and dance heritage of white toppers and stilettos, shiny floors and short-skirted high-kicking. Can-can, they sure do. The crowd, they love it.
A cocktail of effervescent words and pictures, Rob's photographic essay is now playing on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Nina Schick from the EU policy think tank Open Europe and Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London. Let's head to Israel now, a country with a new defence minister. But not everyone is happy with Avigdor Lieberman. Some analysts say his appointment is a sign that Israeli politics is lurching dangerously far to the right. Do they have a point? Well, Nina, first of all, let's just paint a picture. Who is Avigdor Lieberman and why has he caused so much controversy?
Well, he is, so basically, he's known for his forthright views. He's living in one of the settlements and one of his policies. He's actually been in office before. He's been a minister before. I think he was foreign minister, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And he thinks that Palestinians who've been convicted as terrorists should immediately get the death penalty. He thinks these settlements, including the one that he's living on, which is the United Kingdom and Europe recognizes illegal, should be expanded further. So the fact that he's now become the defense minister, which is a very powerful position, people think just signals the fact that, you know, a two-state solution in Israel is and Palestine is by the wayside.
Which he doesn't believe in, indeed.
Yes, he himself doesn't believe in
it. Make sense on the surface of it that he should be appointed defense minister, I think one of the possible explanations is that a number of senior figures in the Israeli armed forces, either serving or retired, but crucially serving, because usually they wait till they've retired to become more vocal on political issues, have been talking about a veering towards, in effect, fascism inside the Israeli body politic. And this has incensed the Prime Minister, Netanyahu. And it's Netanyahu who's ousted his Minister of Defence, who was one of the ones who was expressing concerns, had military background and was expressing concerns about the trends inside Israel vis-a-vis the occupation of Palestinian territories and Palestinian people and treatment of Palestinians and disregard for human life when it comes to the Palestinians. He is incensed by this and is on a path of confronting all those who are criticizing his preferred hardline with the Palestinians. So it's a way, by appointing Lieberman to the defense ministry and putting him in charge of the armed forces, it's a way of telling them who's boss.
Now, Lieberman doesn't have a great kind of defense experience, and that's one of the other reasons people criticize him. But on the charge that he's, you know, no dove, when was there an Israeli defense minister who was sympathetic or empathetic? Or do you think that we've misread the from outside? We always think of the Israeli army being, you know, very, you know, strong and powerful.
Tough and all the rest of it. Yes.
But you're saying there's behind that, there was a little bit more nuance and perhaps we didn't detect before.
Well, perhaps it's not always understood that a lot of senior politicians in Israel have had careers in the military. Yitzhak Rabin would be a classic case in point and did serve as defense minister. And he his recipe for dealing with the first Palestinian uprising or intifada that broke out in December 1987 was to break their bones. Now, he thought that this was a way of quelling the uprising of the Palestinians without killing anybody. So he thought using batons to break Palestinian limbs, bones, was better than firing live ammunition. But on the outside of Israel, across Europe at the time, it sounded terrible, break their bones, especially since they were demonstrating without arms and were indeed hurling rocks and occasionally Molotov cocktails at the Israeli armed forces, which could be lethal. But nonetheless, it was pretty much in those days women, children and youths uprising, civilian uprising. Unlike the second Intifada, where the Palestinians were using violence and suicide bombers on a much larger scale indeed. In those circumstances, the Israeli military, whether as retired officers and in politics or in the forefront of countering Palestinian resistance to occupation, are very much part of the mix, part of the dialogue. And it's also important to remember that the draft is the norm in Israel. So everybody does their military service. What's swung in Israel is that whereas you could in the past have expected the military leaders to be more hardline than the politicians, the postures have reversed.
Well, we're going to move on to our final story of today. France has been going through something of tough times too recently, as a labour dispute has led to disruptions around the country. The government has tried to suppress the unrest before a European football tournament kicks off. Nina, not in the football stakes, but what's really at risk here?
This is such a typical French situation. I mean, the French labour market desperately needs reform, but of course leave it to the French government.
Well, that's what we say. They say that many people in France say it does not need any reform.
Sure. They have over 10% unemployment, and you know, I know that the French are very proud of the soft life in France. However, if you consider...
Oh, you're going to be getting a few emails
I'm going to be getting some, definitely. If you look at a similar situation that Germany has been in and how they managed to, with the Agenda 2012, pull themselves out of their economic depression, the UK as well. Okay, well, let's not get into the economic arguments behind it. But it is very French in the sense that the government decides to do this, you know, when they have less than a year left in office. And this is something that's happened before. And Hollande knows that this is going to basically kill his bid to be president again. But now he's determined to get it through. And of course, the unions are massively opposed to it. It's just not being accepted very well in France. But hey, I think in the next presidential election, if it is Juppé going to run, he's already said, you know, we have to face up to the fact that we can't afford to live like we've done up to this point. We have to be more competitive. We can't have a 35-hour work week and 8 weeks of paid leave every year. We need to kind of pull up our socks and get into the race a bit more.
Rosemary, is it the kind of the soft French versus a kind of like Anglo-Saxon working world out there? Is that really what the battle's about, do you think?
Well, I was going to suggest something different, because I think surely when they measure it, the French are more productive when they do work than the British workforce.
Even you're saying it when they do work.
I don't like this British sport of having a go at the French.
It's you two. It's not me. But tell me, Hollande's handling of this. It does seem to be another bit.
Not exactly adept. But then I was reminded of the doctor's strike, the junior doctor strike in the UK. And the minister in charge in the UK was getting a lot of flack for his mishandling of it. But always in such circumstances, there's bargaining going on. And the government needs to send the message that this is a red line issue and we're not going to give in on this, because otherwise the government's authority will be questioned on all sorts of other areas. But they can only go so far with that if the strikers are enjoying popular support and mounting sufficient of a challenge, that then the minister starts to be judged on how well he's handling the crisis. And Hollande doesn't seem to have got the combination quite right.
Well, and there's been so much controversy around this, because what Hollande did was basically bypass Parliament, because he knew he couldn't get the votes of his socialist MPs. So he did this via a constitutional measure, which is another reason why, you know, people are incensed. You can understand it's seen as a power grab. But he's sticking to his guns. He's saying this is definitely going through. But I think one of the reasons he can stick to his guns is because he knows his political career is over.
Woo!
And Rosemary, 10 seconds, but do you think it's going to be for the Brexit people here who hate, you know, the idea of France and all its rules? Do you think it's helping the people who want to get out of Europe?
No,
all these images on TV?
Actually, no, I don't.
Okay. Okay. That's Rosemary. She's trying to protect her holiday there as well, I think. Yes. We're going to leave it there. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Don't email me, email them. Rosemary Hollis and Nina Schick, thank you so much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Faith Barker, and Elise Tennant. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, and at 1900 hours, it's Section D. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. From me, goodbye.